Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. The Sword Priest's surprise assault upon the Abbey has been stalled by Kerla and her companions, giving the monks time to retreat to their next line of defense and prepare for a siege. Chapter 36. Kerla and the others waited near the sealed gate as more and more of the Abbey's residents came running in response to the alarm. The rush of combat was fading, leaving her hollow and tired. Allie appeared to be feeling much the same, slumped against the stone wall, watching the activity in front of her through heavy-lidded eyes. Wick was examining the two long swords he had collected from the sword priests, testing the weight and balance of each to see which suited him better. She looked for Jordan, picking him out with little difficulty. With the horses hobbled and grazing, he was now gathering the younger children around him beneath a tree, keeping them out of the way. She hadn't seen all of the Abbey's children in one place before, and was surprised to see there were over a dozen of them, their ages ranging from 5 or 6 to only a year or two short of Jordan himself. She couldn't make out what Jordan was telling them over the noise and activity all around her, but by his gestures toward the gate and the high walls around them and the confident smile on his face, she guessed he was talking about the strength of the Abbey walls, how many times the Abbey had defended itself from attack, and that this would be no different. She smiled, seeing his words bolster the children's courage, her heart swelling with pride on Duke Stephen's behalf.
"Mistress Sakir," said a monk running up to her, "the abbot would like to speak to you."
Kerla got to her feet.
"Keep an eye out for Grievous," she told Wick. "I'll be back soon."
Then she followed the monk into the gatehouse and up a long set of stairs. On the first floor, several monks were opening large chests, taking out unstrung crossbows wrapped in cloth. These were passed to other monks, who were seated on the floor around a large sheet of paper listing instructions on how to string and prepare the weapons for use. One monk was reading the instructions out loud, guiding the group through each step. When she came out onto the roof of the gatehouse, the abbot stood at the battlements with a cluster of other monks, looking out at Lowgate. He gave Kerla a sad smile when he saw her.
"I understand your folk have sharp eyes, my dear. Until a telescope is brought down from the preservatory, I would appreciate your assistance."
"Gladly, father," Kerla said. She gestured toward the floors below. "I didn't know you had weapons of your own."
"Some," the abbot admitted, "packed away for such an emergency as this. Our walls are high enough to discourage casual raids, but against a determined foe, the walls must be defended. Unfortunately, we always expected Lowgate to be our first line of defense. Most of our crossbows and ammunition were stored down there."
Kerla stepped up to join him, looking down at the growing cluster of pilgrims. Several of them, directed by one of the sword priests, were coming out of the large gatehouse, carrying chests identical to the ones she had just passed.
"It looks like Kelisandra knew exactly where those weapons were," she sighed.
"Yes, it seems she has been planning for this. Her people now have more weapons than we do, but behind this wall we provide her with few targets, and all of us are required to train with these weapons twice a year. The training is rudimentary, I will admit, but I dare say we will be more accurate than the pilgrims, if further violence proves unavoidable."
Kerla gave him a grudging nod as she saw something else. The door to the registry was open.
"Those aren't the only weapons they have," she added, pointing to the open registry door and the small crowd of pilgrims emerging into the daylight.
She recognized the graceful shape of Grievous's argument and retort in the hands of two of them, and a moment later spotted her own sword in the hand of a third. But in addition to their new weapons, the pilgrims were carrying other things and dumping them into a large pile.
"They've opened the weapons locker in the registry. And," she added with a sigh, "they're burning the logbooks."
This news was received with horrified silence as all the monks on the roof came to look.
"Father's wisdom preserve us!
one of the younger monks said, and Kerla was surprised that the sight of the burning books seemed to affect the monks as much as the sight of their dead comrades.
"Back to your tasks," the abbot ordered gravely. He stared out at the growing bonfire, and Kerla saw him come to some decision. "Brother Lazam?"
The older monk, whom Kerla knew was one of the abbot's senior staff, hurried up to him.
"Yes, father."
"How much water is in the cisterns?"
Lazam was not prepared for the question.
The cisterns? Yes, they're being cleaned and refilled."
"I know that," the abbot said. "How much water do we have now?"
"Approximately 50%, Lazam replied. "We're about halfway through the cleaning process, so one cistern is refilled, one hasn't been drained, and the other two are in the process of being drained, cleaned, and refilled. I don't know their exact status."
"I see. Plug all the cisterns at once, and shut off the flow to the bathhouse to speed with the refilling. And send Brother Tamba up here."
Lazam's eyes went wide, but he nodded without comment and headed for the stairs.
"Father, who's Brother Tamba?"
"Master of the Hydro Works," the abbot replied. "Have you seen Commander Fletcher down there yet?"
"Not yet."
"Wait, there she is. She just came through the gate."
The abbot came over to stand next to her, squinting in the direction Kerla was pointing. The Mother of Steel was easy to pick out at this distance, once more wearing the red tabard of her order. She was speaking with a lieutenant Kerla had seen earlier and several other sword priests, probably the rest of Kelisandra's guard. The lieutenant was quickly briefing her on how the attack had gone and their current status. She saw Kelisandra glance at the bonfire and ask the lieutenant a question, shrugging when she got the answer. Then she knelt down next to the prone form of Padrick, who was still paralyzed by Kerla's spell, and the body of the acolyte Wick had killed, the one named Braylon, and gave a brief prayer for both of them. When she rose, she began giving orders, dispatching one of her men in the direction of the smithy, others toward the greenhouses, apothecary, and stables, each of these men collecting a half dozen pilgrims as they went.
"What is she doing?" the abbot grumbled, squinting.
"Dispatching salvage teams," Kerla replied. "She's sending groups of men into every building to see what she has to work with."
The abbot sighed.
"There is much she'll find useful."
He turned as another older monk came up the stairs.
"Brother Tamba is here. Excuse me."
But before he left, the abbot put a kindly hand on her shoulder.
"Before I forget to say this, child, you have my deepest thanks. Even if we have left Kelisandra with more than we wished, she has far less than she had hoped for. If not for you, her men would likely have seized Midgate before it could be closed."
"You're welcome, father," Kerla replied, patting his hand.
After the abbot moved away to speak with Brother Tamba, she watched the pilgrims and sword priests consolidate their gains below.
"Whether it's land or sea," she mused, "if there's trouble, I always seem to find myself up in the crow's nest. That's all right, though. I'd rather see what's going on."
She recalled her night in the observatory with Brother Hallam and tried to picture the grounds surrounding the abbey.
"Jordan said there's a tunnel that goes under the walls. So where would it come out?"
She felt a pang of guilt at the thought of abandoning the abbey in this time of crisis, but it was something she knew she could live with. Jordan was her priority, and if the abbey was no longer the safest place for him to be, it was time to leave. Her major concern now was learning where the tunnel led before leading her group into it.
It's got to go somewhere, or the monks wouldn't have put a gate down there. But seeing how eager the abbot was to talk about Tesca's family, there's no point asking him about another of the abbey's secrets. Jordan's never been beyond that gate, so that leaves Brother Pharaoh.
She felt a thrill as the realization blazed across her mind.
That must be how he was getting outside to heal the pilgrims.
She did a rough count of the growing crowd in Lowgate and gauged that over half the pilgrims were inside by now, with more coming in every minute. It wasn't hard to pick out Kelisandra's men among them. Aside from being armed, they moved differently, a confident assurance that the pilgrims lacked.
If she brings everyone inside the abbey, Carola thought, then there's no one outside to see us slip away. I just have to get Pharaoh to tell me where that tunnel comes out.
Then she noticed that Kelisandra and her lieutenant were walking toward the middle gate, stopping some 50 yards away. Within crossbow range, but she knows no one hears that good a shot. Her lieutenant then raised a stick with a white flag tied to the end.
Father, Carola called, it looks like Kelisandra wants to parley.
The abbot hurried to her side and looked down.
Perhaps there's a chance to put an end to this madness.
He looked back to the other monks.
Pass the word. No one is to shoot at her. I repeat, do not attack.
There were a few long minutes of silent waiting as the abbot's order was spread and the acknowledgement came back. The abbot sighed and turned back to the battlements.
You may approach.
Kelisandra and her lieutenant came up the road, stopping some 20 feet from the gate.
Walter Banbrook, Fletcher called, you are ordered, in the name of the Triad, to open your gates and surrender this place.
How dare you invoke the Triad,
the abbot roared, his strong voice ringing off the stone walls,
when you are the one who has assaulted us. You have spilled blood upon this sanctified ground, committed kidnapping and murder upon brethren of the abbey. You defy the authority of the hierarchs.
Crown's not sanctified, it's corrupted, Kelisandra threw back. Harboring an elf ye are, she who's standing at your left hand even now.
The abbot sucked in his breath in surprise at this, but for Carola, this only confirmed what Patrick had said to her in front of the gate. Somehow, the sword priests had learned she was here.
First day I met her, watched her hand ye orders with my own eyes, I did, Fletcher called. Her magic it is that's behind the false miracles. Bait to lure the faithful. Turn them from the ways of the Triad to your heretical cult.
She nodded at the shocked expression on the abbot's face.
Aye, Banbrook, judgment's come for you. But you needn't suffer the flames. Send the elf out. Reject her, redeem yourself. Won't be forgotten at your trial.
Where are my people? The abbot demanded, the four whose robes you stole.
Alive for now, awaiting trials of their own.
Kelisandra's eyes narrowed, displeased that the abbot had changed the subject.
If this gate stays closed, we've little else to do. Suppose we'll have those trials tonight, right here. Give everyone something to watch.
You wouldn't dare,
the abbot gasped.
One who's never been in battle can't know what one who has will dare to do, Fletcher snapped. Coming through this gate I am. Only question for you to answer is how many more will die before that happens. The four in the barn, the ones we captured in the gatehouse, those behind your wall. How many?
The abbot looked as if he might be sick, closing his eyes and breathing a silent prayer.
Father, give me strength,
Carola heard him whisper. Then he composed himself and opened his eyes.
All of them.
Kelisandra started at the answer.
What?
I will never open this gate to you, Commander Fletcher. By allowing the logbooks in the registry to be burned, you have made it clear that you have no respect for our calling, and you shall not burn another single page. And if you murder your prisoners, I will stand here and watch every minute of it, though the sight break my heart, for it will only strengthen my resolve to keep you out.
Kelisandra and her lieutenant stared up at the abbot in utter disbelief.
You're going to resist me? Over books? She demanded. You'll let your people die to protect your bloody books?
It is our calling, the abbot said gravely. To join the community of St. Rivino is to pledge our lives to the collection and preservation of the world's knowledge. Every one of us will defend that calling to the death, and were I your prisoner instead of any of those currently in your keeping, I would pray that each of them would give you the same answer that I have.
Carola saw a tear roll down the old man's face, but his strong voice never wavered. She glanced behind her to see the other monks standing on the gatehouse, and felt a chill run through her as each of them nodded in agreement with the abbot's words.
"Bold words," Kelisandra sneered. "Perhaps they'll comfort you when your fellows burn for heresy. Taken over a dozen fortresses I have. One more's no trouble."
"This abbey has stood for over 500 years, Commander, and has never fallen to assault."
Kelisandra laughed.
"You've not half the numbers you should, Banbrook. Not enough of you to keep me off your walls, and you haven't the weapons to keep me from coming through your gate."
"Perhaps, but what you don't have enough of is time."
"Time? You expect to starve me out? Enough food in your greenhouse for a day or two at least. And there's no better motivation for a hungry soldier than to tell him his next meal's waiting for him on the other side of the wall."
"I'm not talking about food," the abbot replied. "I'm talking about water."
Fletcher frowned at this, suspicious.
"The well on the farmstead is your only source of fresh water," the abbot called down. "Have you never wondered where that water comes from? It comes from the underground river beneath us, and we control its flow. Retreat with your followers back to the camp and release those prisoners you have taken, or I will order the river diverted. The well will be dry before dark."
Kelisandra went very still as the full import of the abbot's threat crashed upon her.
"The question is now upon you, Kelisandra," the abbot said. "How many of your followers do you want to watch die of thirst?"
Kelisandra made no reply, but simply stared up at the abbot and Kerla for a long moment. Then she turned and walked back down the road, her lieutenant stepping directly behind her to shield her from any missile fire.
"That should give her something to think about," the abbot commented.
"She certainly wasn't expecting it," Kerla said. "Thank you, by the way. There was a part of me that feared you might do as she demanded and send me to her."
The abbot shook his head. "I could not send you to that damnable woman any more than I could throw a book upon the fire. You and your party are guests in this place, making use of the knowledge we have gathered, and contributing knowledge of your own in return. The spread of knowledge is as much a part of our calling as the collection of it."
Kerla flushed, not expecting such an answer. "All the same, Father, thank you again. Were you bluffing about cutting off her water supply?"
"No," the abbot sighed, "though it is not so simple a matter as turning a spigot on a keg of beer. Harnessing the river's power took many years of work. There are several blocked passages beneath us that must be opened. Once that is done, we will be dependent upon the remaining water in the cisterns until we can establish some system of manual labor to carry or pump water to the surface."
"And if you redirect the river," Kerla asked, "how long would it take to set everything back the way it was? You'd have to block up those passages again, wouldn't you?"
"Yes," the abbot agreed, "a process of at least a year, I imagine. Triad willing, we may yet avoid that situation. All we need is for that woman to listen to reason for once."
He squinted down at the pilgrims.
"Are they starting to leave?"
Kerla, who had been watching Kelisandra the entire time, sighed.
"No, Father."
The activity below began to increase as Kelisandra started issuing new orders, everyone picking up the pace.
"I think Kelisandra's decided that a thirsty soldier is even easier to motivate than a hungry one."
The abbot shook his head in disbelief.
"She's still going to attack, but how can she hope to succeed? It's madness!"
"It's not hope," Kerla said. "It's faith."
She looked up at the abbot, who was staring back at her, puzzled.
"With all due respect, Father, I don't think you've ever really understood her calling any better than she understands yours."
He frowned at that, but she pressed on.
"You've got to stop thinking about what you expect her to do and start thinking about how you're going to keep her out."
The abbot's scowl deepened, but she wasn't sure if he was angry at her or not.
"I suppose I must."
He turned to address his fellow monks.
Brethren, it would appear that this tragedy continues to unfold before us. Brother Tambor, you may proceed.
The master of the Hydra Works closed his eyes in a silent prayer before nodding to the abbot and leaving the roof.
The rest of you know your responsibilities, the abbot went on. Spread the word to our fellows. We make our stand here. Those assigned to the defense of Midgate shall take up their positions. The rest will begin the evacuation to Highgate. First priority are the food supplies.
He turned to Kerla as the other monks quickly left to disperse the new orders.
You have been of great help, child, but I will ask now that you rejoin your companions and assist in the evacuation.
She was tempted to object, but decided there was little to be gained arguing with him. The abbey was Banbrook's responsibility, not hers. As you wish. Good luck.
It is all in the Father's hands, child. May it be that he has given us the wisdom and forethought to prepare for this challenge laid before us.
May it be, she replied automatically, following the other monks down the stairs and out of the gatehouse. She found Wick and Allie sparring, the guard demonstrating the most common attack forms used by the sword priests and advising Allie on the best ways to counter them. Allie saw Kerla first and put up her sword.
What's happening? Is that old hag still out there?
Still out there, and still planning to come in here. The abbots ordered everyone but those defending the wall to evacuate to Highgate with the food and everything else we can carry.
Understood, mistress, Wick replied. Are we staying down here? I heard there were 10 sword priests in total. One's dead, you crippled another, so that's 8 swords against our 3. Not good odds, but we're on the defense.
The paralysis spell I cast on Padraic will wear off in an hour or two, and we'll be facing more than just sword priests. The monks were storing a supply of crossbows in Lowgate, and Kelisandra knew exactly where they were. Also, they sacked the weapons locker and the registry, so in addition to several dozen crossbows, they've got our blades and whatever else was in there.
Wick made a low whistle. Won't want to see the look on the captain's face when he finds out.
Next to him, Allie made a humorless chuckle and sheathed her sword.
Suppose I should be grateful that I tried to leave when I did? She patted the hilt. Managed to hang on to this, but I lost my dagger and pistol in the crush outside.
Pistol won't be much good to them this far north, Wick said. I'll give this other sword to the captain when we see him. I dare say he'll be glad of the chance to take his blades back himself.
We're not going to fight, Kerla told him, glancing around to make sure none of the monks were in earshot. We're getting out of here. Allie and Wick stared at her.
We are? Allie asked.
During the parley a few minutes ago, the abbot threatened to cut off the pilgrim's water supply, but instead of backing down, Kelisandra accelerated her plan of attack.
What sort of plan could she have? Allie asked. Pray for her people to grow wings and fly over the wall.
Whatever her plan is, Wick threw in, like as not it's a good one. You'd be hard-pressed to find a more experienced field marshal than a senior sword commander.
And the abbot has underestimated her more than once already, Kerla said. I respect the monks and their calling, but defending this place is not what we came here for. I believe there's another way out of the abbey the pilgrims don't know about, and I'm going to find it.
Wick nodded at once.
Allie continued to look doubtful, but with a sigh, she nodded as well.
I doubt they'll treat me any better than an elf, now that I fought alongside you. Am I in your little group, or were you planning to leave me behind?
Oh, you're coming with us, Kerla said. I haven't saved your life just to abandon you to the sword priests now.
How mercenary of you, Allie replied with a smile. Sounds like something I'd say.
Guess you're rubbing off on me. All right, head back to the dormitory and collect your belongings. Wick, collect Grievous's as well, would you? Then help the monks with the evacuation. Make sure all of our gear is collected in one place, and keep your ears open for any news about what Kelisandra's doing in Lowgate. When she begins her attack, whatever it might be, we'll need to be ready to move at a moment's notice. We'll rendezvous in front of the preservatory in a half hour.
Where are you going? Allie asked.
To find Grievous. I'll catch up with you later. Kerla watched the two of them disappear into the crowd of monks, then ran to the tree where she'd seen Jordan earlier. He had gotten the younger children organized into some sort of group game that involved some of the children trying to tag the others. If they succeeded, those children now had to catch the free children as well until only one child was left. Then that child became it, and the game repeated. Kerla saw that right now, the game's primary virtue was to keep the younger children from dwelling on the danger beyond the wall. The older children played the game as well, but were not so easily distracted. Their gazes kept drifting back to the gatehouse, making them easy targets to be tagged by the younger children. Jordan was shouting encouragement to them, breaking off as he saw Kerla approach.
"I'm glad to see you're all right."
"Likewise," she said. She was about to tell him that he needed to get ready to leave when she noticed all the children had stopped and were staring at her.
"Are you an elf?"
one of the younger boys asked, surprising even himself with the bold question.
"I..."
Kerla glanced at Jordan, who gave her a sheepish shrug.
"Yes," she finally said, seeing no point in lying. "Yes, I am." "I heard your hair was green," the boy said, "but it's red. Nobody's got green hair."
"I do," Kerla told him, "but I'm wearing a disguise right now. Would you like to see me take it off?" A silent chorus of emphatic nods made her laugh, and lifting one hand, she snapped her fingers, letting her disguise melt away. The children gave a collected gasp, followed by, "Ooh."
"Oh, her ears!" a girl squealed with delight. "They're all pointy."
"Yes," Kerla laughed, glancing at Jordan in a silent plea for help.
"Yes, they are." "How do you do that?" asked an older girl. "Is it magic?"
She looked crestfallen when Kerla nodded. "Wish I could use magic." It took Kerla a second to recognize her. It's the girl Jordan was tutoring in algebra. What was her name?
"You're Maya, aren't you?"
The girl's eyes went wide in surprise.
"Jordan tells me you're really good at math. Well, can I tell you a secret?"
Maya nodded.
"I'm not very good at math. It's really hard for me juggling all those numbers. That's something I've always wished I could do."
Maya gave her a nervous smile, still taking in her appearance, when Jordan finally stepped in.
"All right, maybe you can ask us some more questions later."
He tapped Maya on the shoulder.
"You're it."
Quick as a flash, Maya swung around to tag another child, but the boy leapt out of reach with a delighted yelp. As the children became distracted by Maya's new status, Jordan turned to Kerla.
"You did that very well. You've a way with children."
"News to me," Kerla said. "Not as if I've had much practice."
"I suppose. Is there something you wanted?"
"Two things. The abbots ordered everyone to evacuate to Highgate with the food and supplies."
Jordan nodded.
"I'm sure I'll be told to take the children up there soon, then. What's the second?"
"I need to talk to Brother Pharaoh. Do you know where I could find him?"
"Normally, this time of day, he could be anywhere in the preservatory. But this isn't a normal day, is it?"
He frowned, thinking.
"Try the infirmary. I'm sure that's being set up to receive casualties. Why are you looking for him?"
"I want to know more about that tunnel you explored, the one that goes below the abbey walls. I think Pharaoh knows where it leads."
Jordan paused, his eyes narrowing.
"You want to use that tunnel to get out of the abbey?"
"Yes, if it comes out somewhere on the other side of Kelisandra's forces."
"But," he began, looking bewildered, "now?"
"You saw how fast Kelisandra was able to seize Lowgate," she explained. "I'm not willing to put all my trust in the monks to protect us from her. I promised your father that I'd bring you to Kohane, and you agreed to come with me. If I find another way out of here, we're taking it."
Jordan scowled, crossing his arms in a stubborn pose she was now all too familiar with.
"Jordan, I don't have time to debate this with you. I like this place. I respect the monks and what they're doing. But I am not dying for them, and neither are you. I'll come find you later."
She took off across Midgate at a run before Jordan could reply, heading for Highgate and the preservatory. No one stopped her as she ran, though she did get a constant stream of stares and pointing as she passed the monks. When she emerged from beneath the last gatehouse, she saw a crowd outside the preservatory. Several monks were directing the visiting scholars here as they came out of the large building and were organizing them into smaller groups. Her eye was drawn almost at once to three dark-skinned figures a short distance away, standing near one of the outbuildings of the preservatory. Grievous and Drusus were in deep and urgent conversation, while Drusus's apprentice stood a step away, watching the monks and looking worried. He saw Kerla almost immediately as she approached, which didn't surprise her. Without her disguise, she didn't blend in at all. The younger man turned to his elders to interrupt their discussion, and when she reached them, three impassive Sabrian countenances welcomed her.
"You are safe," Grievous said, looking relieved, then taking in her disheveled clothes. "But you have not avoided trouble altogether, have you?"
"Not altogether, no."
"What has happened, precisely?" Grievous asked her. "We heard the alarm, but reports have been sporadic. The monks are not telling us everything."
"Kelisandra seized Lowgate," Kerla explained. "She killed several monks, but Wick, Ali, and I held her acolytes off long enough for everyone else to evacuate to Midgate and seal it against her."
"Ali? You mean Mistress Fane?"
"Yes, she was just outside the abbey when the attack began and managed to cut her way back in. Then I saved her life. Now she owes me a debt."
Grievous's eyes glittered with amusement.
"Very interesting. What of Benito and Clegg?"
"They didn't make it back inside. I don't know what's become of them."
The old Sabrian nodded.
"Very well. So it is to be a siege, then?"
"That's right. The monks are planning to defend Midgate, but the rest of us have been asked to help bring the food and supplies up here to Highgate."
Grievous raised his head and sniffed the air.
"A fire has been started. Even from here, you can smell the smoke, yes?"
Kerla caught something in his expression, noting how his eyes lingered on her, and she took that as a cue, sniffing the air herself. There was indeed a hint of the burning registry logbooks in the air, but there was something else as well, faint but familiar, the tang of alchemical smoke and fumes.
"It's coming from Drusus," she realized. "He's still conducting his experiments, whatever they are."
"Yes, I can smell it," she said, knowing which scent Grievous was asking her to confirm. She looked at Drusus and his apprentice, who both regarded her as if she might bite. Realizing this was probably the first time they'd ever seen an undisguised elf before, she ignored their apprehension and gave them a pleasant smile.
"Master Drusus, how are you today?"
"Well enough," the scholar replied after a moment, his sense of decorum too deeply ingrained to meet courtesy with rudeness.
"Yes, today is a bit unusual," she said. "I don't suppose either of us would like to come face to face with those pilgrims outside, would we?"
Drusus almost smiled at that.
"I suppose not."
An awkward silence fell over the group before Drusus coughed politely.
"We should join the other scholars." "Yes," Grievous replied. "Given the information you have shared with us, I believe that we will be asked to catalogue the inventory as you bring it up."
He looked frustrated.
"Perhaps young Master Tarn may retrieve what few possessions I have left from my room, while I remain here with the other old men, counting sacks of grain and crates of salted pork."
Kerla grinned. "I've already asked him to do that."
Then she paused, remembering the other thing she had to tell him.
"Captain, I have some bad news for you. The pilgrims broke into the weapons locker."
"My blades have been taken."
"Yes."
Grievous closed his eyes and took a long breath. After a moment, he whispered in Sabrian,
"Two slender strips of steel. What is there worth?"
Drusus, who had been about to put a hand on the captain's shoulder in sympathy, started upon hearing those words and looked away, embarrassed, letting his hand drop. Kerla frowned at the scholar, unable to see what Drusus had found so disturbing.
"What was that you said?" she asked as Grievous opened his eyes.
"Hmm?"
the Sabrian replied, slowly focusing on her.
"Ah, the beginning of a poem I learned many years ago, that is all."
He glanced at Drusus, and Carla knew Grievous was too fluent in body language not to see the scholar's frosty mien of deep offense, but he gave no reaction to it as he returned his focus to Carla.
"Thank you for telling me this, my friend. We should now all put our labors toward the defense of this place."
"Of course," Carla replied. "Right now, I'm actually looking for Brother Pharaoh." Drusus's head came around at the name, a little too quickly to be casual. "Have any of you seen him?" she asked, meeting the scholar's eyes.
"Brother Pharaoh," Drusus replied slowly. "I am not familiar with that name."
As with all Sabrians, he maintained a mask of cool, polite inscrutability, but he wasn't half as good at it as Grievous, and Carla read the lie on his face.
"My apologies," she said. Still annoyed with the man for his rudeness to Grievous, she couldn't resist a final jab. "I'd heard he was the monk helping you with translations."
She didn't bother glancing at Grievous. She knew he would make the connection she'd voiced.
"Anyway," she went on, "I heard he might be in the infirmary. I'll try that next. Stay safe."
She didn't look back at the Sabrians as she entered the preservatory. Grievous likes a good mystery. Mulling over what Drusus is up to should keep him from mourning the loss of his blades. And she had to admit that the mystery intrigued her as well.
"The smell coming off of him isn't quite what I smelled that night in the tunnels. Whatever it is he's working on, he's refined it."
She turned down a hallway, then stopped.
"This isn't the right way. Still too easy to get lost in here. Slow down. Think. When I left the infirmary, I came down a set of stairs and into a passage that led through the Hall of Demons. So let's get there and backtrack."
It was the first time she had ever traveled through the preservatory by herself and found the experience more unnerving than she'd expected. The preservatory was always a quiet place. The abbey was underpopulated, so there was plenty of room for the monks to spread out and have their own private workspaces. But she'd always been able to hear some sounds of human activity. Now that the abbey was under siege, virtually everyone was outside right now, and the silence had become a heavy, cloying weight. She wasn't the only person in the building, she knew that, but there were sporadic, quick things, the echoes of a set of running footsteps down another corridor, or two monks hurrying past her, breaking off their whispered, hasty conversation when they saw her, silently watching her as they passed by. After each of these incidents, the silence seemed to press around her more strongly than it had before. She tried not to let her imagination get ahead of her as she navigated her route through the stone passageways, and for a moment wondered if she could find her way to the observatory on her own. Having an eagle-eye view of the surrounding grounds might be useful. Maybe I could even see where the tunnel comes out. And the abbot might value reconnaissance like that as well. She sighed, realizing that thought had come from a desire for more light and open air. A few more windows, she thought, that's all this place needs, although they'd probably say that would be bad for the books. She found the Hall of Demons, and from there was able to retrace her steps back to the staircase that led up to the infirmary, drawn as much by memory as the growing and welcome sound of human activity. The infirmary's main chamber was wide, with a high ceiling, and was one of the few parts of the preservatory with large windows that could be opened for fresh air. A score of monks were bringing spare cots out of a storeroom and laying them in close-set rows, while others were arranging medical supplies on a series of long tables. She quickly picked out Brother Pharaoh among them, a solitary point of stillness in the center of the room, directing the activity like a conductor. He spotted her at once, surprised and curious as she approached.
"Back for more of that tea?" he asked with a smile.
"Actually, it's a bit more than that," she replied. "Can we talk for a moment?"
Pharaoh's expression turned more serious than quizzical, and he beckoned another monk to take his place,
then led her out of the infirmary and into the hall, closing the door behind them.
"We probably should not be seen together too frequently, you know."
"I know, but this is important. Kelisandra started this attack to capture me."
Pharaoh's eyes flared wide.
"They know we are here."
"They know I'm here," she said, mollifying him. "Kelisandra didn't say anything about you, and she certainly would have if she'd known there were two elves in here instead of one."
She paused, seeing Pharaoh wince.
"Sorry, not elves. Fae. It's going to take me some time to get used to that."
"Of course," Pharaoh replied.
Then he sighed, rubbing his eyes.
"This is so tiresome."
"Tiresome?" Kerla asked. "She seized Logate and killed several monks in the process. I'd call that more than tiresome."
Pharaoh looked puzzled for a moment, then somewhat embarrassed.
"Well, yes, of course. A horrible tragedy. We just wish to be left alone, to pursue our questions in peace, and leave such answers as we might find for later generations."
Kerla nodded, letting his glib reply go unchallenged. She wanted to like Faran, to spend days in his company, talking to him about things only they could understand, learning everything she could about their heritage, her family, and magic in general. But there was something about him that always put her off, always set her instincts on edge, and now she had finally realized what that was. He's not human enough. After meeting the assassin on the night of the Duke's fete, she had always believed that she had faced down a monster, no true representative of her people, but now she recognized something that he and Faran had in common, a lack of respect for humans.
"Faran heals people instead of killing them," she thought, "but he's not doing it out of compassion. He just needs test subjects for his new spells. And he sees nothing wrong with erasing the memories of anyone who stumbles across his secret. Triad's mercy! Is that why Father refused to teach me anything of my heritage? To keep me from becoming someone like this?"
The thought was staggering, but she did not let Faran see it on her face. As much as he made her skin crawl, she needed him.
"Jordan told me that one of the tunnels beneath us extends beyond the walls and leads to a locked gate. That's the way you use to get outside the abbey to heal the pilgrims, isn't it?"
"Jordan again," Faran sighed. "I'll be very pleased when you're able to take him away from here. Yes, that's how I was doing it."
He gave Kerla a sharp look.
"You're not thinking of asking for the key, are you?"
"By no means," Kerla lied. "I'm as eager to keep as much distance between me and the sword priests as you are. But I wanted to let you know the abbots ordered the underground river to be diverted."
Faran rolled his eyes.
"Oh no, has it come to that already?"
"I'm afraid so. If the cisterns are only half full, how many days of water will that leave us?"
"The river is still running beneath us," Faran replied. "We can send people down with buckets and hand pumps. We just won't have the surplus we used to."
He sighed.
"And the bathhouse will be dry until the water flow is restored to it."
"I see. But with more monks moving around in the tunnels, doesn't that mean someone might find your laboratory?"
Faran's eyes went wide.
"Oh dear, I've got to get down there straight away."
"I'll leave you to it then," Kerla said. "Oh, there's one other thing. The abbot's using me as a lookout, since I don't need a telescope to see what Kelisandra's up to."
"Very good, very good," Faran muttered.
"I don't want to use the tunnel to get out," Kerla said, "but wouldn't it be good to tell me where it comes out, at least? If I see a group of pilgrims around that area, that could mean they've found the entrance. And if you're down there taking your lab apart..."
Faran chuckled.
"That certainly would be dreadful, but they won't find it. We've nothing to fear on that account. The tunnel leads into a larger network of tunnels extending throughout the plateau, old channels cut by the river. But all exits to the surface were sealed off by the monks centuries ago. Well, except for one, but... oh, they won't find that."
"Are you sure?"
Of course, it's an evacuation route for the Abbey, in case of emergency, but it's miles away and well hidden. Very tedious journey, I can tell you. So, even if the pilgrims found it, they would have to navigate through those tunnels to get back here. It could take them days to find the right route.
Carla nodded, wondering how much food and water she could get her hands on before taking her group into those tunnels. But there was something about what Ferran said that piqued her interest. Before the miracle started happening, she thought, he used to slip out of the abbey regularly to test his spells on the pilgrims. But he's got no patience for tedium, so if the journey through the tunnels took that long, he'd look for a shortcut. Or he'd make one.
I guess you know that cave route like the back of your hand now, she said as he was turning to leave, since you were healing the pilgrims yourself for a while. But that must have been a long walk.
Ferran glanced back at her, lost in his own thoughts.
Oh, yes, dreadful. I can only imagine. I mean, you'd have to go through the tunnels, then walk back to the abbey above ground, test your spells, then make that whole long trip once more just to come back? Exhausting.
You've no idea. Such a waste of time.
I know I'd try to find a more efficient way to get out and back, she said, imagining what she would try if she'd been faced with such a problem. Perhaps there's another tunnel that gets close to the surface near the farmstead?
She watched his face and saw his lip briefly twist into a smirk.
If the farmhouse has a basement, she ventured, which got no further reaction, or the well.
Again she saw that self-satisfied flicker.
The well! You made a shortcut that comes out in the shaft of the well!
Ferran sighed.
You know you can't tell anyone. We promised not to reveal each other's secret.
I won't tell anyone. How long did it take?
2 years, Ferran said. Those spells your mother taught me to shape matter proved very useful. Exhausting work, shaping rock, but it got the job done and was a useful learning experience.
How do you get out of the well shaft? I tried creating a spell once where I could cling to walls like a spider. That didn't go so well.
Ferran laughed. No, I shaped handholds in the rock for climbing.
You didn't put an illusion on it?
Spoken like your father. That's what he would have done, but I haven't his skill. Too much distance and mana would be required for me to sustain it, or I would have to keep going down there every day to recast the spell. My movements in the abbey were not so free as that in those earlier days. It would have been noticed. Instead, I used a more mundane form of illusion. By putting a slight overhang at the top of each hole to conceal it, they can't be seen from above.
He looked rather pleased with himself.
Very clever, Carla replied. Oh, but I'm sorry, I'm keeping you from...
Ferran gasped.
The lab! Yes, I've got to get down there.
Good luck, Carla called, as Ferran headed back into the infirmary, unable to keep a smile off her face as she headed back to the stairs. It was half a minute before another figure slipped out of a nearby alcove next to the door, padding silently down the passage to take the stairs as well.
This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.